Hi, Charisse here with a special announcement. You can now enjoy select episodes of Detailed in video form. That's right. Detailed is now available on RCAT's YouTube channel. Now, you may be thinking, I already listened to the podcast. No need to watch it on YouTube. Well, trust me, if you don't want to miss out, even if you're an avid listener of the podcast, the video format is a completely different experience. Not only is it like hanging out with us, but you also get to hear parts of the conversation that were left on the cutting room floor. You can also see the photos, drawings, and video as we discuss the incredible projects that are featured. Come join us on YouTube. Follow the link in our show notes, and let's get into the details. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
Adults and kids like to be in the sun. So if we can get them on the rooftops, it's our only sort of compromise where we don't have a normal outdoor playground. And New York City schools rarely have play space outdoors because the constraints. And so we were able to bring two play spaces for hundreds of kids and adults. And I'm really excited about it.
So if I create something that isn't just a sidewalk where a 5v5 soccer game is going on, which I've seen, or a basketball game, you know, with the portable nets, they are adapting to new environments. And the more they adapt to new environments here during their formative years, the better they'll be able to adapt, I think, as they move out in the world. That's sort of just a design philosophy I have.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, senior specification writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guests today are David Briggs, AIA, Lead AP, CPHD, Principal and Founding Partner at Loci Architecture in New York, and Dr. Adrian C. Manuel, Executive Director at Merrick Academy Charter School. Dave founded Loci Architecture in 1998. His firm has completed a wide range of projects, including master plans, feasibility studies, new construction, exterior restorations, building renovations, and interior designs in various sectors such as academic, cultural, residential, and commercial projects. He is a LEED accredited professional and a certified passive house designer. In addition to his architectural work, Dave has a strong interest in urban planning and community activism. He is the executive director of Gowanus by Design, a nonprofit organization that focuses on long-term urban design strategies in the Gowanus Canal area of Brooklyn. Adrian, as the executive director of Merrick Academy, oversees the strategic vision and operations of a high-performing charter school that serves over 500 students in Queens, New York. With an EdD in educational and organizational leadership from the University of Pennsylvania, he brings more than 20 years of experience in transforming K-12 education through innovative and inclusive practices. He is passionate about empowering the next generation of learners with the skills and mindsets that they need to thrive in a rapidly changing world. His mission is to inspire, mentor, and drive systemic change that bridges the gap between today's learning and tomorrow's challenges. The project we will be talking about today is the Merrick Academy Charter School in Queens, New York. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. In the bustling borough of Queens in New York City stands the future home of Merrick Academy Charter School, poised to become an institution of educational innovation and community empowerment. Located within a vibrant neighborhood, the new 60,000 square foot building promises to be more than just a structure. It embodies the aspirations of a community committed to nurturing young minds and fostering a passion for learning.
We wound up with a site that allowed for about, I think, 60 or 70,000 square feet as of right, meaning, you know, it didn't need any special variance or anything. And Adrian has 1,000 students planned, you know, K through 8. So that works out. We have about a 60, I think we wound up with about a 61, 62,000 square foot building. That's about 60 square feet per student. That is compact. Whenever I meet somebody for the first time, I tell them, well, budget 85 square feet per student. The charter school up in East Harlem, they took over an old school building. They were down, I think, in the 50s, but they didn't have a gym. They had an auditorium, which was the gym and the cafeteria. So the planning was a challenge just to fit all the program spaces in there. And we did, I think, a really good job working with Adrian and his team. Rael was another guy intensely involved, making sure that we got all the classrooms, we got a cafeteria, we have a full kitchen, a cooking kitchen, we have a full-size gym, we have a community center, all the other things, nurse's office, science labs, dance, and we have two roof spaces, which are incredible because of, you know, outdoor space is such a premium here in New York, especially for students to have a safe outdoor space where they can study and you know, play games. So it was an exercise in how to be super efficient with our space layout.
It was really easy for us at the school to conceptualize the project. Now, one, because we didn't even know what we would need to do. So we were living in the space of what it could be, right? It's the folks like David and others who are like, well, no, wait, there's some compliance things and there's only enough rooms we can fit into the space. But I came from a place of, what's the best vision for our students? And we currently serve K through 5, but we just got approved to serve K through 8. So we're gonna have an elementary and a middle school. And so I started from that place of like, what's the best program of study and, you know, learning ecosystem we can put together that's true to our core mission and values? And we've been around for 20 years, so it's true to our sort of legacy and what was important to us with student learning over the years. And so from our sense, it was more of like putting our best ideas together, but also thinking about not only where we are today, but thinking about what, like, if this is a brand new school and we get a chance to kind of design from scratch, how do we build a school, or what kind of programming for learning will still resonate and be foundational 20 years from now? When we, you know, that's really hard to even imagine, because if I imagine 5 years ago, we've already been through things I would have never predicted, right? But this idea of like, let's be really thoughtful about our space and what it could be, and create some ability to be agile so that some of the spaces, if they need to evolve over time, we're not constricted. And so that's where we were. And so when we connected with David and his team, you know, he did the great work of like hearing our ideas and trying to put it to a design, and then, you know, fitting all that into a really small footprint, right? A lot that, you know, if we could get more size, we would love more size, more space, but lots here in Queens are pretty small, and it's already really difficult to get real estate out where we are. So we were just excited that we could bring our vision to him and he could find a way to make it work in the architectural plans.
With a focus on STEAM, science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics, every inch of the space is crafted to inspire curiosity and creativity. To understand the driving goal of Merrick Academy, Adrian illuminates the philosophy of STEAM.
One thing that I learned a long time ago, and this is roughly my 24th year in education, and it's being reinforced every year that I've been working in this field, which is schools are just a reflection of our society, right? And so we have little people, whether it's elementary students like we have here at Merrick, to middle schoolers going through adolescence, to high schoolers, you know, ready to go into the world for college or careers. And, you know, the behaviors that we have, the issues we face, the things that we try to educate towards, are always a reflection of the society that we live in, right? And so if you take a look around at our world right now, we hear nothing but nonstop information about artificial intelligence. Is it, you know, going to transform us for the better, or is it going to, you know, take over like the Terminator? And so we're living through that. And one of the things that I always remembered going back to my graduate school days, and we learned early on, is that, you know, in many ways, the history of school in the United States has always been about sort of the economical and social revolutions and changes throughout time. And so the first sort of compulsory schools happened when the Industrial Revolution was happening, right? So we needed kids to learn reading, writing, and arithmetic and learn how to be good workers, so to speak. And many of our systems today are still built on that. And so STEAM is really, in the last decade or so, there's been a real recognition of, you know, the information age that we've all now experienced and we're well into, what's happening with social media and networks, how we're going to solve climate change, but maybe use technology and things to help solve it or clean up the environment. And so you can make a really long list of sort of where we are in time and space and where the world is going. And so STEAM schools, I like to think, are schools where the leaders or the teachers or the community involved in the school have a real deep recognition for where the world is and where it's going, and understand that some of the ways that we can face the challenges that we currently have and the challenges for the predictable future is by educating young people to be digital natives, to be responsible with technologies, to understand some of the real foundational things in math and science that have helped to transform big breakthroughs, not just on the tech side, but even on the scientific side. Like, we still have an ocean to discover what's out there. We still have space. We still have climate issues. So it's really just a school's commitment to ensuring that there is really deep learning in those fields of science, technology, engineering, the arts, and math. There's also a recognition that the arts play a role in that the creative side and the innovative side goes hand in hand with technology and science. All great breakthroughs where somebody designed or a team of people came up with a new solution. So it's a recognition of that, and it's trying to build a school learning program around that and the training for the adults to teach that. How do you build space for that? How do kids have access to 21st century or futuristic robotics labs or science labs or spaces where they could do gardening and environmental science in some really dynamic ways? And so STEAM is really an acknowledgement of where we are and definitely where it looks like we're going, and helping young people be prepared for the world.
Navigating the labyrinth of New York's real estate market is a well-known challenge. And for Adrian and David, the task of securing a suitable space can be complicated for a charter school.
One of the challenges of all charters is that you have to find space to run your program. And, you know, if you're already in a city and there's been district schools there, you know, since school started, which there should be, right? There's already a local high school, elementary school, middle school. Well, there's really not much real estate for you to move into. And there's not many buildings commercially that were previously schools that you can easily convert. And so charters find themselves doing a couple things. They either, and I don't know the data on this, but I would say that this is at least my experience and what I know from my network. A good amount of charter schools, maybe more than a third, will find a space that used to be an educational space. Maybe like my current building, as we're waiting to move into the new building, is an older Catholic school that was closed down over a decade ago, and Merrick is leasing this building from the Catholic Archdiocese, right? So this used to be a school. It was shut down due to whatever happened in terms of changes with enrollment and history. And so we're able to come into a space, and you'll find a lot of charters are looking for spaces in the cities and localities that they're in. In some cities, like in New York, you have schools that have been closed down or are no longer serving a need in the community, and a charter can move into that space, renovate it, lease it, co-locate. So in New York City, you have some buildings where perhaps there was a time in the past where there was 3,000 students on a high school campus, but because of changing demographics, there's now 2,000 students. And that high school has a lot of empty space, so a charter school might come in and co-locate. That's a unique thing in New York, but I've seen it in a couple other cities out there, but it's not normal. And then lastly, you're looking for space. You're either looking for space that you can renovate to run an educational program. And again, that depends if you have young kids to older kids, because younger kids, you need a lot more sort of things for programs in terms of, like, if you're going to do a pre-K program, you need bathrooms in your classrooms. To if you're going to have a high school, you need state-of-the-art labs to prepare kids for college work. So I probably, and David may have a sense of this, but I would say that probably less than a third are able to go ahead and do their own building project. But I also would say that I think part of it is the longevity of a charter school. So the longer a charter school has been around, the more likely I think they are to have found a space, maybe put some financing together or did a bond project so that they can make a construction project happen. So there are charters now, since charters started in the late 90s, there are charters who've been around for a decade or two and have gotten pretty good at opening up a new building and then opening up another new building. So I think we've got some traction now with more and more schools feeling the need to put together a project like this. But we don't often have the bandwidth, and we don't have the scale of big districts to have people on our team that can say, here's what we've got to do. We've got to find great people like David who are going to hold our hand a lot through the process and teach us what we need to know so we can make good choices about a project like this.
So there's a couple different scales of charters. There's sort of standalone charters like Adrian's School, and then there's the big networks like Success Academy, KIPP, Uncommon. Typically, ground up construction is done by the larger networks. I don't know too many standalone charter schools that have built their own building. We've done probably about 30 charter school projects at this point, and a big chunk of them are in old parochial schools. The Archdiocese owns a lot of property here in New York City, so does the Brooklyn Diocese, and they have a lot of real estate that they can no longer use, and that's nice because it was built as a school. It was, usually 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago, so it's a little bit outdated, but it was built as a school and it has sort of the infrastructure to support a school. Some other times you have to move into commercial buildings and try to make that work, but that gets difficult for, like a gym, which needs a double height space. And the co-location was very popular several years ago when we had a different administration here in New York. It's less popular now. It's always been a little bit of friction there because the traditional DOE schools feel like they're being displaced by a charter. So standalone schools for building their new a new facility custom is rare in New York. I feel very lucky to be working on it. When I approached Adrian and introduced myself and he expressed interest, I really thought we were going to wind up renovating something else. And then I introduced him to a developer who actually had a lot and everything came together. So it's going to start construction in about a month.
Crafting the school's program presented a challenge. Demanding spaces that could accommodate diverse needs within a confined square footage, including a full-scale kitchen and community center.
I guess we've done enough charter school projects where we just know there's some constraints. And it's usually budget. I don't want to say it's at the detriment of the school design. I think it actually offers opportunity. But it is something we have to be cognizant of, and I mean, that's part of our job. And certainly, just actually when the full kitchen came up, I was amazed. I was like, wow, you're really going to do a full kitchen? Because I don't think any of the other charters we've worked with have done that. They do warming kitchens. So the Department of Education will bring in lunches, and they'll get warmed up, and they'll be served to the kids. When they proposed this, I was very excited. I have to admit, in the beginning, I was skeptical, and yet it's in the plan, and it is there, and it's going to get built. And the things that made that particularly, design-wise, a challenge were some of the new infrastructure requirements of New York City, because New York City, if nothing else, is very good at being reactive. It's not always too proactive, but we have to have things in this building. First of all, the building's all electric, so there's no oil or gas. There's a stormwater detention tank underneath the kitchen. There's a cistern. There's a large electrical transformer that has to be on site in a place that's away from everybody. And all these things were sort of pressures on the space. So, Adrian brought up the community center where he wanted people from outside the school, people in the community, because this is serving an underserved community in New York City, have a place to go to access resources that Merritt could offer. Very exciting initiative. And again, that was just more square footage. So we worked really hard on just carefully putting this puzzle together three-dimensionally. And I have this great project architect who's from California. He came in to work on the project a year and a half ago, and he's been doing an excellent job. And he's got, if God forbid, if he gets hit by a bus, because I'm in trouble. he's got this thing built in his head, and we've really been able to, if you can imagine a Rubik's Cube, just keep moving things around till we got everything that Adrian wanted. That beats the code.
Frequently, funding for a charter school is constrained by various avenues. Fortunately, Adrian and the Merrick Academy stumbled upon a unique opportunity to secure funding.
The funding is a challenge for charters in general. There's only a few pathways of how we can go about thinking about a project like this. It may be that we've got really deep capital reserves or an endowment from, you know, great partners. That's rare. That's some of the bigger networks David has talked about that might have that kind of ability. You can go for like a bonding project where you can do bond financing and go through that route, which, you know, the environment the last couple of years has been a little challenging just with the rates and everything else. So we were looking right in the heart of the time where, you know, if you were watching the news about the Fed, it was like every couple of months, like, what's the Fed going to do? Are they going to raise the rates? Are they going to sell? And that's at the time we were engaging with a developer, thinking about purchasing land. And we're like, oh man, if we don't move quickly, like these rates are ticking up and all of the sort of how that goes through this, I feel like of a snake eating a meal and it kind of wiggles through, like that affects everything else, the cost of materials, the cost of projects, you know, coming out of COVID, there was all this stuff where like you couldn't even get certain inventories of things. So we knew that was a route, but we very quickly decided it wasn't the right time for that route just because of the financial ecosystem right now. And so we were very lucky to find a developer who's, you know, doing the project, building the building. We have a lease agreement where there's a mechanism where we can purchase the building in the future where the conditions are going to be more favorable for us to go for bond financing. We just felt like a lot of things in the last, I mean, you know, who knows what's happening in the next year with the economy, but we just felt like it wasn't the best time to do that. So we were really fortunate to have a developer where we can do that, move this project forward, lease the building for the first decade or so, and then have a mechanism to purchase the building and have it, you know, be part of our legacy and what we move forward with. So it is a bit of a unique situation, and it's always difficult for charters to look for funding for these types of things because we're also managing everything else. And again, we don't know if we're a smaller standalone charter or a small group of charters, we don't have the people capital. We don't have chief financial officers and facilities people who can normally advise us on this. We're kind of a small mom and pop shop sometimes. And so it was unique, and I'm glad that we got to this point.
With a funding pathway in place, David and his team crafted an engaging exterior design, blending brick, metal panels, and glazing while infusing playful patterns, vibrant colors, and dynamic geometry.
With charters, as we've touched upon, you know, budget is always a consideration. And so we have a toolkit, and the toolkit is simply, you know, masonry, brick, EIFS, you know, exterior insulating finish system, sometimes metal panels, and glazing. You don't get into fancy exterior finishes such as granite or terracotta because they tend to drive the price up quite a bit. But what you can have fun with is the colors and the patterns and the geometries. And those are the three things that we try to bring to every charter school project because they are not, you know, their cost is, they're free. It really just takes the talent. I have a couple of wonderful people here in the office. I'll just give them the, you know, the three or four things. I say, this is what you have. It's like going into a kitchen. These are the four ingredients you have. What can you give me? And they come back and say, I can give you this. And again, I've been very lucky with the project manager on this project, Keita, who just has a really, really nice eye, and Sai, also in our office, who worked with him to create the aesthetic for the exterior and make it a very attractive, fun, but not silly fun, but fun building that you say, okay, there's my school. And, you know, and parents can connect with it and say, you know, that school's special. It's a little bit different than the other buildings in the neighborhood. You know, scale-wise, it is contextual, but I think schools need to be, in their own sense, palaces, but palaces to the community. They're not, they don't have to look expensive and you know, forbidding, you know, that you have to walk up steps and be a little nervous going inside. You want to go in. You want it to be a community center. You want it to be a connecting point.
To further maximize space utilization, the team designed the rooftop area into a multifaceted recreational oasis. Among its features are a turf field for gym classes, box gardens for science lessons, and versatile wellness areas, offering a dynamic environment for holistic growth in learning.
We're currently challenged for space where we are in our current setting. So when we engaged David, we knew that it was going to be hard to find any kind of space where we could give our students like a playground or play recreational space. And just like we're compactified here with everything kind of, we're in a very tight space, but we found a little area to put box gardens to run a garden program. We have a parking lot for cars, but we don't allow any cars to park in the parking lot because we use it as the playground, right? So there's trade-offs in New York City to make things work. What is really exciting about this project is David not only was able to give us some outdoor recreation space and space for some of our programs, but give us like double the space we could have imagined. And so we've got two rooftops built into the design. Both rooftops have a space that's going to be like a turf field, right? And that's multi-purpose. That's when it's warm out, spring and fall, kids can have gym classes out there. If it's a beautiful day, a teacher can bring a class upstairs onto the rooftop, sit down on the turf in whatever way they want to and do some of their learning, reading. You can imagine all the possibilities. So we have this outdoor recreational multi-purpose space. But along with that, we put a couple features into the designs. One is on both spaces, we're trying to create a space for like our box gardens, right? What better to get sunlight than on the roofs? And so we've got programming for our young kids and our older kids, middle schoolers, where they're doing gardening, they're doing environmental science, they're looking at climate studies. So we're building in opportunities on the rooftops for them to engage in those types of activities. We also, in the last couple of years, have been pushing really, really hard, especially coming out of COVID, when we brought our adults back, our staff, and that was before the kids came back. So we had a couple weeks with staff. You know, we found that, and I think this is across the country, like there's a high anxiety and high stress rate. And we wanted to really move the needle with wellness initiatives with our staff. Like we wanted to do more to bring, you know, mental health and, you know, just wellness activities for the staff and the greater community. So we put a space that's like a playground, but it's sort of like those playgrounds. And New York City has a couple of them in different places where instead of like a normal jungle gym, there's like exercise activities. There's things for fitness, and they could be for young people or older people. So we envision that our middle schoolers and our staff will have a space on the roof where there's some like wellness, play, fitness activities. And, you know, we don't have that space now, so we're excited about what we can do with that kind of space. And then I think just in general, we're very much a community school that's focused on like engaging the broader community. So we bring in like folks from some of the local health clinics, and we run clinics on our campus. We have our local councilwoman is up the street, and she does a turkey drive every Thanksgiving, and we give her our school to bring hundreds of families in for the turkey drive and then some educational programming. So whoever we've been able to partner with our in our community, and remember, we've been here about 24 years, so we've got some really deep community roots. We kept saying like we need spaces for community activity. So we have this physical community center space, but we envision both rooftops not only being a space for students and adults with different activities and educational programs, but also just a further extension of community programming. So if we want to run, you know, I mentioned our staff fitness activities, maybe we're doing an initiative in the local community about health and wellness, and we run a health fair up on our rooftop and teach people local gardening techniques and yoga and other whatever we can put together with our partners. So we see it as a multi-purpose space, a health and fitness space, a recreational play space, a gardening space, and probably whatever else we can innovate to use both of those spaces. I think one of the spaces fits around just under 500 students, if I remember from the last drawing, roughly. So you could imagine the kinds of events a school can have on a rooftop and be outside, right? Like we have the gym and it's great, and we'll use the gym for a lot of communal activities, assemblies and so forth. But, you know, adults and kids like to be in the sun. So if we can get them on the rooftops, it's our only sort of compromise where we don't have a normal outdoor playground, and New York City schools rarely have play space outdoors because the constraints. And so we were able to bring two play spaces for hundreds of kids and adults. and I'm really excited about it.
In order to facilitate the rooftop's recreational areas and accommodate public gatherings, David had to devise a roofing system that not only adheres to safety standards, but is also inviting for children, teachers, and parents to come together in a welcoming environment.
So the advantage of designing a new building is you can create, you can design a new structure and create the supporting system required for getting a lot of people up on a roof. It's much harder in an existing building because the structure typically wasn't intended to support an occupied roof. So that made things a little bit easier. The steel has to be a little thicker. The deck has to be a little deeper. And then you have to provide a 10-foot fence around it as required by the code of for any active or passive recreation with children involved. Having a public assembly space on the roof is a big, big accomplishment, which I'm proud of. And as Adrian said, you know, when you get students and teachers and parents up there celebrating on a beautiful spring day, it's just a wonderful, wonderful scene to look at. And I want to say, New York City children, I've seen them play in the most god-awful places and still find joy. And what's great about creating a place that's better designed, more attuned to what their recreational needs are is, you know, it's some of these kids are going to move out of New York at some point, and they're going to go to different places in the country, in the world. And they need to understand, I think, from an educational and just a physical perspective, that there are different types of environments out there to engage with. So if I create something that isn't just a sidewalk where a 5x5 soccer game is going on, which I've seen, or a basketball game, you know, with the portable nets, they are adapting to new environments. And the more they adapt to new environments here during their formative years, the better they'll be able to adapt, I think, as they move out in the world. That's sort of just a design philosophy I have.
There were two primary goals when it came to space planning. One, cultivate spaces that encourage a natural flow for the students, and two, safety.
From the school side, there were things that we were able to bring to David's attention, and some of them were already in his attention. So where we were able to really design for like the needs of the school and the vision. So we thought about things like how our students are going to flow through the halls, and the assembly space being like, you know, on the first floor and a really big stairwell for the kids to go up and down the stairs, because we know managing kids through halls can be difficult. We thought about issues with school safety, which we know, unfortunately, is always in the news. And we live in a society where school safety can be compromised, and we can have an active shooter type of a situation, or we should be planning for those types of things in our world. And so, you know, where we put our main office, how what we put on the first floor is a lot of big public spaces, but then there's the heart of the school above. We wanted to have certain adults on every floor, right? So there's some schools where like the main office is the first floor. And I was a high school principal. I had about 3,000 students, and I had about 5 buildings that were connected with these like glass bridges. And, you know, we had a pretty big campus. We had like 20 acres. This is in upstate New York. But all of our offices were in one of the buildings. So if we didn't actively walk to the other buildings, we could go through a whole week without seeing kids and adults in another part of the building. So David was really intentional to put offices on every floor. So there was, you know, the therapeutic supports for kids like counselors and social workers. We thought a lot about the need to tutor students and have small groups, which we know is something that is needed to personalize learning. So we built these small spaces for like small group rooms where like 3 or 4 kids could be tutored. And we were able to design that in. So I think there's a good amount of features, and there's plenty that I'm not mentioning, where we were able to talk with David and his team and kind of work through like what we felt was needed for the flow of the building, for the safety of the building, for the vision that we have for our students, and then just really good practice in the educational space right now, where if me and my buddies get around each other and we're like, man, if we could just build a school that actually had, you know, windows with light coming in, the schools would feel less like prisons sometimes, because a lot of city buildings don't have a lot of light coming in because they're just the way they're designed. If we could have air conditioning, and like if we can have this kind of space or that kind of space. So you can imagine the conversations. So I think in terms of David's planning, as much as he's saying he dealt with like the elements and the space and the colors, he was also dealing with kind of our constant pushing, like, well, we're going to need this, or we're hopeful to have this. And for the most part, he made 90% plus of those things work in the design and can't be understated, because there's many a schools that I know that there's spaces that they wish they had that we were able to build into this design. So excited about that.
Inside, the cafeteria, equipped with a full cooking kitchen, promises delicious and nutritious meals, while specialized therapy rooms are thoughtfully interspersed among the classrooms, ensuring accessibility and support for all students.
I think the cafeteria holds 230, 240 people, and we really, you know, had to maximize that as much as we could, and we were angling walls and stretching and pulling, and what we had to wrap our head around there is how many lunch shifts were there going to be during a day, and how did that affect just the school flow. So I think we landed on 4 lunch shifts, and Adrian and his colleague Rael would sort of, you know, bounce back to us operationally what that meant, and then, you know, how the students would flow out of there. And then once we were past the cafeteria, we would move upstairs, and, you know, the classrooms were pretty, there were a certain number of classrooms, kindergartners, first graders, second graders, so on. But the specialty rooms, we had to consider, could they serve a couple different functions? There were therapy rooms that are included, 12-1-1 rooms. And, you know, all these things, just the placement, you know, we would create a plan. You know, you start with a spreadsheet of program space. We would create a plan. We would share it with the school team. And they would come back to us and say, okay, we could use one up here. We could use one down there. So again, it goes back to my Rubik's Cube analogy, where you just have to keep sort of moving things around. And unfortunately, with the software we have these days, because we use Revit for this project and all of our projects now, it's a lot easier to keep moving those three-dimensional spaces around. And then, you know, obviously at some point you have to lock it in because the structural engineer has to get to work. But we spent a lot of time on that, several months.
The dynamic between society and the environments we inhabit significantly influences human behavior. Adrian, keenly attuned to this interplay, prioritizes the significance of youthful design. He aims to underscore how students can authentically express their aspirations within a space, fostering a sense of ownership and empowerment.
You know, I think in some cases there's some things that educators all know. I think parents know it, and I think society also knows it, because we see it in other spaces. So I remember learning things like a mall or a department store keeps the temperature cold because it keeps people awake and it keeps them more likely to shop. There's certain features and environments between light coming in and how you lay out something that will dictate and influence how people behave. And I think what often goes for granted is that young people deserve that too. And, you know, I am a historian of sort of education in a way of like looking at how we've made choices about our systems and what schools are and how they look. And, you know, and in many ways, the one thing we all share is we were all in school, right? And so we have these things that, regardless of if you're in school in California or New York City or upstate New York or, you know, down south, there are certain features that are usually there, right? We don't always get the most light coming in our classrooms. We always have hallways that seem a little bit stale. There might be something that's being taught that's being promoted around the school, but sometimes that's like the adults like it and it looks good, but the kids would rather something else. So I think, you know, with this design, there's a lot of spaces that we had intentionality for, knowing that we've got kindergarten through fifth grade, right? So, you know, light plays a role, open space plays a role. We talked about those rooftops. My experience as a middle school principal is that when kids feel that the learning ecosystem, the physical space, the psychological space is beautiful, right? I know that sounds cheesy, but if they're in a beautiful, pristine environment, they do behave differently. They'll think twice about breaking something or doing something. I also think that when the space reflects them and what we're trying to do with them and their age and what they like to see, whether it's beautiful colors to plants in classrooms to state-of-the-art things, when they know that that's what they deserve, all that has to be thought through. And so, you know, these last 20-something years working in education, I can't say I've ever figured out the right equation to make a perfect space for a middle schooler. What I can say, though, is that when we, you know, make a gym that's for, I had to go through a process once of like renovating our school gym. And we easily could have had middle schoolers that would break anything in that gym. I mean, I can remember that rowdy group. But, you know, we put up the school mascot, which our students did a competition to create the mascot. Our students had a competition to create the school colors. So as a charter school, there's some things you actually have to define, right? What's your mascot? What's your school colors? What are you about? We had our student government participate in that. So when we put, you know, the nice padding on the gym walls with their mascot in their colors, with, you know, the stage that they said they wanted because our students wanted more performing arts, nobody really broke anything. Nobody put graffiti on anything. In fact, students would be very prideful. And if you left something in there, they'd be upset. Hey, this is our gym. So I find that adults oftentimes design for adults, or what we think young people like, because we were young once. I think listening to students, I think being very sensitive to kind of their ecosystem, what makes them tick, what they like, how they behave, I think all that matters. And I think that's what you put into part of the design. Some of that is the architectural construction. Some of that is how we decorate the space, right? So I'm excited because it's a challenge. I know we have a good design and we have good people on my team who will create a space for our kindergartners in the building who will be there, and also 14 and 15 year olds in eighth grade who will look much different than the young kindergartners and could be intimidated if it was the wrong environment. So I think we plan with all that, we design for all that, we build for all that. And you know, educators know if you put students first, a lot of good things can happen. We just oftentimes put what we think is right for them first. And so that's just kind of my value system in schools, is like put kids first, connect with them, see what they want. This generation is not the same as my generation, is not the same as my parents' generations, but we can find schools in this country that still look the same way as they did for my parents, they did for me, and now they do today in 2024 for young people. And that's not right. And so I just try to be intentional around a lot of those things and sensitivities.
A selection of durable and practical materials is also crucial to extend the life of a school.
You know, you can't design a school so it's bomb-proof. I mean, because then it's just concrete block. So what you do is you select materials that are resistant, say like impact-resistant gypsum wallboard, but that can also be easily repaired. We also place lockers along, you know, in traditional schools, the old parochial schools, they would have these heavy clay tile walls up, you know, wainscoting up to maybe 4 or 5 feet. And that was great, but that tile isn't really out there anymore. And you don't want to use, you know, an American oleum tile that looks like someone's bathroom. I mean, there's nicer tile out there, but then that starts increasing the construction cost. So you get fairly particular about where you place things. So the hallways, they have to be wide in a school. You put lockers against the walls, so now the walls are protected by the lockers. And the lockers are pretty robust, you know, they're metal lockers. But the gypboard is, you know, it is gypboard that they put in, you know, institutional type settings, but it still looks like gypboard and it can be painted and repaired easily. The kids are, you know, with their backpacks and just swinging around, that probably does as much damage as anything. The stairwells are, I think in this school, we're leaving them just as concrete exposed on the inside because there's just not much you can do there. They're running up and down the stairs. You don't want them on the elevator unless they have to, or if they're in a wheelchair or on crutches because they injured themselves. So you have to pick your spots where the durability is. And then the flooring is just simply BCT. It's a good, durable material for a school type setting. And then the ceilings are the ceilings that we all grew up with in schools. It's the acoustical ceiling tile that we threw our pencils up to and see if they stuck. And so they're already perforated. So there's a few more holes because of the pencils. That's okay.
Beyond spatial constraints, local laws and regulations also created technical challenges within the infrastructure design.
Well, this is what I touched upon before, was the New York City passed local laws here, and they passed local law 97 a few years ago, and that requires electrification of buildings over, I think, 25,000 square feet. So this building is fully electrified, and because of that, there's a lot more power coming into it. So that's bucket number one. Bucket number two are the stormwater resiliency requirements that were enacted a few years ago that came out of Hurricane Sandy. And those two things are bumping up against one another because we have a small parking lot that encroaches on the east side. Yeah, the east side of the lot. That's an easement we're granting to the neighbor. And that's going to have a dry well under it. And then next to that is a cistern. And then next to that is a stormwater retention tank. And in that same area, I think it's 4 kV of power has to come in from the street under the building to a transformer. And they go back into the building all above this infrastructure that's subgrade to power the building. And then the third thing is the remediation for the radon. So there's a lot of things that just technical things that we have to contend with to make sure that the building is obviously safe and meets these requirements for the students and for the longevity of the building. There's been a lot of back and forth between us and the developer on space requirements, holding to the program. We made some suggestions. We suggested putting in a partial basement, but that doesn't, to accommodate, the dry well, the cistern, the stormwater retention tank, but that just simply isn't the budget. So all these things are just subgrade with access from above. And we had to make sure the access didn't interfere with the kitchen and some other utility rooms that were directly above it. So it's a challenge, but that's just something we've just had to deal with and work out with the engineers.
With a building chock full of unique characteristics and features, I asked David and Adrian to hone in on some of their favorites.
I'm excited by the building design, and I'm really excited to be standing out there on Merritt Boulevard and see the building from the outside. My second favorite thing, I know you didn't ask for that, are the rooftops. I'm so jazzed about that because the closest park, I think Adrian said, is about a quarter mile away. The kids have to cross streets to get there. Seeing an active outdoor space on the property is great and, sort of capping off what I think will be a really lovely building.
Yeah. So David, I'm glad you're the trailblazer with two answers because it allows me to do the same. The first answer is quite easy, which is everything. And that's because we've been existing for the last, we've been leasing this current space that we're in for about 14 or so years. And before that, we were leasing another space. Both spaces, this one is an older Catholic school that had been closed down. It's very limited. The hallways are tight. We're a steam-based school, but we can't do a lot to the infrastructure to bring in the kind of technology because we'd have to break down walls to create labs. And there's just a good amount of things that we're constrained with in the current setting, but we've been able to make it work as best as we could. So everything in this new design that we worked through with David, when I said earlier it was like we had this vision, it was all the things we know we currently don't have in our current setting, and we know that it creates constraints for what we're able to do with kids. And so there's no real feature of this building that I'm not excited about because we put a lot of thinking into what we wanted to see, knowing that we have a constraint space, and this new building represents that. But if I snuck in a second answer, it would either be the kitchen or the rooftops, or the rooftops and the kitchen in that order. And the thing I'll say about the kitchen is that part of our value system is that we want to bring healthier food options to our students. We want them to also learn about nutrition and health while they're with us. And so instead of having a warming kitchen, we actually are going to contract with a group that will cook in-house, and we can have a lot more influence over the meals and how kids get exposed to different types of meals with vegetables and foods, cultural foods, nutritional foods. And then when we want to do any types of, anything else in terms of like morning snacks or afternoon snacks, we really can bring kids some of the healthiest choices we can bring to bear. And so I'm excited about that as well.
As the final touches are put in place, excitement mounts for the grand opening of the Merrick Academy Charter School in the fall of 2025. With its state-of-the-art facilities and world-class faculty, the school is poised to become a shining example of excellence in education and community engagement. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. I was curious about what are the current trends in school design and what changing needs are driving those trends.
I don't think you can approach a school these days without thinking of safety. There's always something in the news about something that's happened somewhere. And the challenge is, how do you design a safe space without making it look, you know, like it's just defensive. Defensive spaces don't do much for anybody. You want transparency, you want comfort, you want inclusivity. You want a space that should be, you know, obviously promoting tolerance. So conceptually, that's something we have to think about a lot. I've had some crazy conversations with security experts that say, well, you really got to, you know, all the exterior glass has to be mirrored so no one can see in. And it's like, wow, what are we creating here? And fortunately, we've never had to do anything that extreme. But, you know, a lot of schools in New York City have metal detectors now. That's something I never grew up with. So, you know, you have to be cognizant of that. I think flexibility is a second thing. The old model that we grew up with back in the you know, 60s and 70s is really passe at this point. And you need spaces that can serve more than one use. I mean, real estate's getting more expensive. Property's getting more expensive. Construction is definitely getting way more expensive. And schools are not really super well funded in this country. So you have to be able to design with a limited budget while meeting a school's academic initiatives. And finally, you just have to create something beautiful that's really a centerpiece of the community and not something that's out in the periphery. But the thing I love about Merrick and some of the other projects we're doing here in New York is they're smack center in the communities they serve. And I think that's a great design challenge and a wonderful opportunity to create something, a beacon, if you will, of learning that gives the students and their parents, because there's a lot of parents here who did not go to college, and they're sending their kids to schools that encourage going to college. So there's a lot happening at the family level. And this is why I was very excited to hear about the community center at Merrick, that I think the school needs to support and be aware of. So designing for that and making it seem more welcoming to not only the student, but the entire family, the community is critical for us.
It's very hard for me to not say the word AI in this sentence. I think AI is really transformative. I think we're at the very early dawn, but I think it's going to be a rapid change. And schools in particular have to meet the demands of how this is changing society. And, you know, after all, we're preparing young people. And so I think that's a big movement that affects how, you know, I think about schools and school design and educational program design. I know my colleagues are very worried about as well. I also think in the last few years, there's been another sort of big focus, which is on like civics and interpersonal skills, just looking at where adults are nowadays in society around the world in our country and helping people be better at communication, helping people be better at sticking up for what they believe in, but not tearing each other down. So like civics, good old fashioned civics is important, but spaces for that, right? Like these things have spaces. So communal spaces was really important in this design. So we can get groups of kids together to talk about topics, to bring to bear like a forum on an issue. So I think there's that. And then I mentioned earlier STEAM, which, you know, integrates the arts and everything else. I mean, we're very quickly advancing as like a technological society. We've gone through this like information age. We're now in perhaps an AI type of age. And schools are always a reflection of society. So as society changes, as the global politics changes, and, you know, whatever you can, you know, climate change, all the issues that we face as humankind. I know that's really broad, but like in some way or another, schools are about preparing young people to be successful and thrive in whatever world they'll find themselves in. I'm a parent, and, you know, I think being a parent gives me a superpower in that, like, I have the privilege of being influential with hundreds and thousands of kids in terms of their school program. And I want for the students what I want for my own kids, right? Like the sort of psychological safety, the curiosity of the natural world, the ability to thrive in whatever changes or developments or challenges are happening for us in career and society. So I think a lot of that impacts schools. I think a lot of that's going to impact the design of schools in the future. And all that should be considered when moving schools into the 21st century, because a lot of school buildings, especially in New York City, many of them are approaching 100 years old or if over 100 years old. And so they weren't designed with these kinds of learning ecosystems in mind. That's what I get excited about. That's also what I worry about.
I really enjoyed this conversation with David and Adrian. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
You know, my personal background is my parents didn't get the opportunity to go to college. I grew up at or below the poverty line in many different circumstances up until the time I graduated high school. I was told demographically by my counselor in high school that I wasn't college material and I should go off to technical school because kids that looked like me and achieved like me weren't cut out for college. Thankfully, I went to a highly selective university. I got 2 master's degrees and I got my doctorate from an Ivy League. And I don't normally even talk about it because to me, once I got it, it didn't really mean as much as I thought it meant. But I talk about it because I've always worked in education. I've always worked in urban education. I've always worked in communities where what a school can offer to families and to young people is much more than what they see in their environment and what the systems are set up to give them. And so, you know, this building to me is very important. The work we do with students is very important. It's a personal mission. And in many ways, like the impact that I hope to leave is just a legacy of good work in that. And for me, it's not even about big accomplishments. It's about, you know, it may sound cheesy, but it's probably the favorite part of my job. I've now have students who, you know, I was their teacher over 20 years ago, and they're teachers or they're lawyers or they're working in computer science. And, you know, with social media, every once in a while, a former student, you know, and I was their middle school teacher, like, hey, you know, Mr. Manuel, I never forgot you. Here's how I'm doing. And that's the impact that I hope to make, is that I know that I've worked in the service of young people who have a lot of obstacles in front of them working in urban, impoverished environments. And I was one of those kids. And if it wasn't for the power of education, I wouldn't have, you know, and great people in my ecosystem, you know, parents and community members, I wouldn't have thrived the way that I was able to. And I've seen way too many people not have that kind of access and support. So the school to me is really important to bring like a holistic development and feel for students. And, you know, so the work I do is the impact I hope to see, but it's more on the individual basis and hopefully legacy in terms of, you know, making a change in a school system by, you know, having a model that works and other people seeing that and trying to replicate it.
You know, my father was born on a farm, on the farm. He was the first one of 8. He was the youngest of 8 to go to college. He had 2 brothers killed in wars. His father finally decided someone had to get educated. And, you know, and he and my mother, who was also the first one in her family to go to college, you know, said education is important. And they were always pushing that on me. And I always wanted to design schools. But my path has been interesting because I lived as a child in Columbia, Maryland, which was all these open space schools. They were all the rage in the 60s. Now I'm dating myself. And, you know, my teachers were hippies and some of them, not all of them. And a lot, I think the school was pretty diverse, maybe 20% black, 80% white, about as diverse as it got in the suburbs. And then when I was 15, my parents moved to upstate New York, to Albany, 1,300 students, 3 of them black. And then I went to college, and I did okay, and I sort of just stumbled my way through. And somewhere along the way, I found people who started to have some faith in me. And then I moved to New York City. And I have to say, I will never go back to the suburbs. And I understand why people want to live in the suburbs, and that's fine. I get it. I love New York City, and I love its diversity. And a lot of that, I think, goes back to those younger days in Maryland. And I started a nonprofit. I'm on my community board. I didn't want to work for anybody. And as I've been working on projects over the years, I had to sort of create a mission. And the mission is, you know, design for community. And really my goal as an architect, if I were to die tomorrow, hopefully I won't, you know, that I've designed a constellation of spaces around the city that serve a civic purpose, that they are where places where people connect, where we work, where we play, where we learn, where we teach, where we live, and that they serve everybody, not just the chosen few, the ones who can afford architects, but the entire community, particularly the underserved, because as I've been exposed to the culture of New York and its rich diversity, and all its challenges, and there are many here, I feel that it's in my DNA now, and I plan to live here for the rest of my life and design here for the rest of my life.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.